Bad Finger on Radio 3, and Come and Get It, 12:15, Maurice Wasilowski in Melbourne. How are you today?
Excellent, Phil.
Lovely. Well, we've talked loads about driverless cars. Apple are on the bandwagon now, etc. I'm sure we're going to come back to it. I'm interested in VSS Unity and the like, of course, the new Virgin Galactic thing.
Yeah, isn't it incredible? All of a sudden, we're looking at really science fiction-y type things. We're trying to figure out how we make the Jetsons come alive and we fly into space and come back again. And
this thing's supposed to go up 100 kilometres and you can pay $250,000, I'm assuming, US, to get yourself a ticket.
Yeah, it's a lot of money to go absolutely nowhere, isn't it?
They're talking travel here, though, aren't they?
Well, they are. I mean, it really comes down to it's the journey, it's the experience, not the destination here. I mean, this really is what it talks about. It's $250,000 to spend the day to go into orbit, which is literally, as you said, 100 kilometres, you get to see the curve of the Earth, which we would all love to do, of course, and then to come back down again. Apparently, you spend around 5 minutes in weightless space, and that's pretty much it. My concern with it is there's absolutely no room for the trolley for them to serve food on.
I know. You know, the interesting thing here is that the nearest we've got to that kind of super-duper speed flying is, of course, Concorde, and that got retired. And that was really weird. I wonder if you can think of any other examples of technologies that really were before their time.
Well, you know...
What I'm getting at here is, literally, we need to get from here, where I am, to London, and we can do it in a couple of hours tops.
Well, there has been forever, and they're fighting now to bring back, not the Concorde, but to bring back supersonic travel. So that's another thing on the back burner. I found a really interesting, quirky answer, and that is that in 1870, when they were building the New York Underground, they were going to trial what we now call a Hyperloop. And a Hyperloop is a train inside of a vacuum. So if you think about supermarkets thing, sometimes they have the cash register thing where they put a tube in, it's sucked up through a plastic tube and disappears. That's a vacuum tube. And they're talking about doing travel. Now, that was in 1870 they were going to do that. What's really quirky about that is that right now, today, we're talking about the same technology being trialled, and it's again called the Hyperloop.
I bet there's lots of things like that that you saw the germ of many, many years ago, and it kind of disappeared for a while, and boom, it comes back as a real breaking edge technology today.
Yeah, it does. I mean, steam engines were really big in the late 1800s. We were looking at electrical engines. In fact, at one stage around the late 1800s, early 1900s, it was almost a safe bet that motor vehicles would have electric engines, and then petrol and diesel engines and things became more popular and easier to build and cheaper. So that lost the race. So we really haven't come all that far. We're often now reinvestigating things that we thought were possible 100, 150 years ago.
Sometimes in history, stuff has not been disruptive technology. It's been disrupted by the big industries that run it. And I think petrochemical is a big one because it's probably stopped some really nifty things happening over the past 100 years.
Yeah, and there's some wonderful anecdotes and conspiracy theories around that. Really what we're talking about are people with huge investments in infrastructure, making lots of money, which is not a crime, it's what much of the world is set to do, who are either buying up patents which stop a new product or service coming to market, or are making sure that it's very difficult for new players to come in. And that's been the case really up until the last 10 years or so. And then we saw this thing called the digital world come in. And all of a sudden, a lot of the disruptors are now saying, well, the rules have changed, I don't care. And a perfect example, we've talked about it lots and everyone knows it, is Airbnb. Airbnb is an example of a company that couldn't have existed 20 years ago. They are now the third largest hospitality provider on the planet, allowing people to stay in other people's homes. But they don't own a physical hotel. They've never trained a concierge. And they just grow and grow. Now, that's a really interesting technology that lets things happen that we couldn't have seen before.
Everybody I know who's used that says it's fantastic. And you're quite right, it couldn't have happened until fairly recently.
Yeah, I love it. I'm a real rap for it. Of course, there's always the caveats that we talk about, always the careful stuff you need to be mindful of. But having said that, I've used it a lot and I love it. So I've had some really great experiences with it in Indonesia. I've used it in New York to find a really good apartment. I stayed with it with my kids and wife for 2 weeks. It's been a really good product to use.
Yeah. I just got a little message here from one of our listeners, Frank. He says, I flew the Concorde from Oakland, California, halfway to Hawaii and back to Oakland, hit 2.1 Mach, saw the curvature of the Earth, and I got a Louis Vuitton checkbook as a gift. Awesome. That's an interesting thing, Boris.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about, the beauty of travel,
yeah,
which in the old days people loved to experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was very much to be said about it being the journey, not the destination. The old cruise ships were very much about that. It was about the experience you had on board. And it had to be an experience because you were often spending, especially out of Australia or back into our end of the world and yours as well, you were spending a couple of months on the sea.
Yeah.
Going back to this Hyperloop, though, that we talked about before, I met with one of the founders last week who's looking at bringing this thing to life, and it's quite an incredible story. So the Hyperloop are a series of capsules. Each of them will contain about 28 people per capsule. It goes into this vacuum tube, as I said. You sit in the capsule, and it travels at 1 kilometre every 3 seconds. Now, in Australian parlance, that means Sydney to Melbourne, which is about a 1,500 kilometre ride, is 47 minutes.
That's great.
So we're talking about that kind of speed. Now, I thought this thing was a long way off. As I said, it had been talked about in the 1870s and had a new life in the last 2 or 3 years. Elon Musk kicked it off about a year ago by asking why it couldn't be done because all of the technology to make it possible is there. Now, apparently it's a relatively cheap thing to do, cheap being billions, but it's against a $38 billion build, which is one of the things they're looking at in traditional infrastructure for trains, rail and the rest of it. It's a $6 billion build, so it's a much cheaper way of going.
And also then you get into the carbon footprint discussion. People are very divided about that. But
well, this has no carbon footprint. This is literally within a channel, and its only emission is water. It's quite an incredible beast, and again, I thought it was a long way off, but their first prototype, the first little piece of this, will actually be up in 38 months' time in a place called Key Valley, in the middle of nowhere in San Francisco.
Hyperloop.
And he told us of some interesting... He's literally travelling the world. The guy's got a terrific name. His first name is Bebop. It's just a wonderful name. He's travelling.
Like his guide to the galaxy.
Yeah, he's travelling the world now, doing a roadshow, trying to convince governments to build the Hyperloop. He was in Australia last week, trying to convince our government. He told us of a story. He wouldn't tell me which country it was, but he said it was in Saudi Arabia, where one of the sheikhs are very, very interested in this. And the best way this can run is in a straight line. Obviously, the more curves it has, the more difficulty it has. So the sheikh pulled out a map, he said, and he pointed to where he wanted it to start and where he wanted it to finish, which is about 500, 600 k's apart. And he said, anything in the way, just tell me and I'll demolish it.
Do it. Totally believe that one. Let's look at the priorities now of travel, Morris. Okay, Richard Branson's thing, it's what it is. But, you know, people really need to get from A to B. So you've been fascinated with what's happening on the roads. We've done that one. Let's talk macro travel. What's needed? Is it speed?
Well, it's speed. It's also volume, because we know that air traffic, for instance, is going to double every 15 years for the last 50 years. Even through the bad times at around 2010, every 15 years it increases by about 15. It doubles. So every 15 years, air traffic doubles. And if we take that figure again into 2032 and double it again, we're going to end up with 6.7 billion people travelling every year, as against 3.3 billion now.
Why does it double? I mean,
it doubles because middle class increases over the period of time. More people have money, more people want to travel, and travel becomes easier, more convenient, and somewhat cheaper to do. So all those bits and pieces conspire, but it really is the growing middle class, and it's around our area of the world, it's around the Pacific Asia region that it's slated to grow the most. So the answer to your question is that there's a huge desire now to travel. China, I think, is putting on a new airport every 2 months or something, quite extraordinary, and has been for the last couple of years just to keep up with this. You cannot get a plane built for the next 6 or 7 years, except for those, of course, that are in production, but you can't squeeze one into that channel. And same with cruise ships. So there's a lot of infrastructure, a lot of money being put into the fair certainty that people will travel a lot moving forward.
Let's go under the sea, Morris. There was some stuff going around about a Chinese idea for a super fast sub or something like that. It could have been a complete wind up, but I just wonder if there's any thoughts about under the sea.
Well, under the sea has not really been done very well. And in fact, we haven't explored under the sea. We know very little about what happens under the sea. There are some hotels, I know it's not about transport, but there's some hotels and restaurants now that are being built to be under the sea. So there's a strong fascination for it. Again, our friend from Virgin, Branson, has talked about that submarine that you've just mentioned, and he wants to make that a reality. I've not seen any serious prototypes. Lots of conversations about how it might be done. No serious prototypes about it yet, as far as I'm aware. But we're looking at all of these possibilities. It is likely in the next 30, most probably 40 years, that apart from Branson or Bezos or somebody else taking us to the curve of the Earth, that our air travel from city to city is not going to change a lot.
See, this is interesting because I'm wondering if this stuff is obviously just about ready to bloom, whatever it might be, intergalactic or, you know, under the sea pods, etc. Something is just around the corner. So are the airline companies as we know them now, except for Branson, because he's plainly embraced this, are they going to kick up and do their best to stop it?
I don't know if they're going to kick up and to stop it, because they certainly stand to make a quid out of it. And when it happens, they will definitely push that. Look, if I can get to London in an hour or two, which for an Australian is an incredible thing even to think about, there's no way I'm sitting on a traditional plane for 30 hours. So they'll have to get into the game. The real issue is, again, the infrastructure. It's the airports. It's everything that needs to be built around it and for it. And that will take the best part of a couple of decades. Now, even with the best of intent, once it's prototyped, once it's approved, once it is flying, I still see that as 10 years away before we get into that point. And then that's probably 10 years away from that before we start to use it.
So is this what's happened traditionally? Somebody comes along and disrupts a particular industry, and then the good guys just adapt.
Yeah, it traditionally is, especially with something as large as this and as convincing of this. Once somebody has cracked this, like the Hyperloop, once we're travelling into space or whatever it is we end up doing, once it's proven this, there will be so much latent consumer demand that they just can't avoid it anymore. It's not like, we keep talking about the old days, whenever they were, but it's not like the old days where you could keep these things a secret. You could trial them and not tell very many people and then kind of squash it. We're all watching it now. We're all waiting for it to happen.
Yeah. I'm just trying to, I always love to refer back to stuff that would have been so many years ago. I imagine conversations that would have been had when, perish the thought, the bicycle was invented.
Can you imagine? I mean, the bicycle is really the old penny farthing. And in the early days, it was something almost like a scooter that you pushed along, not rode. So you're absolutely right. And that was a crime for women to be able to ride a bike too, don't forget. And if they did, they had to have long skirts. So we can go back to all of this. And can you imagine the early days when there were horse and buggies and cars on the roads in the 1900s? There's some really interesting film footage from New York on the streets of both of those trying to use the same piece of road.
Brilliant stuff, Maurice. We're going to have to put the lid on it. I look forward to talking to you again next week. That's Maurice.